Derechos Humanos para la Unión Americana. Beatriz Salas amplía la información.
Decidir sobre quiénes serán los portadores de la antorcha en la ceremonia inaugural de los Juegos Olímpicos de Invierno en Pekín es la responsabilidad de China, y Estados Unidos no está en posición de hacer comentarios despectivos. Así respondió Pekín a la reciente interferencia de Washington, quien aseveró que la elección de China del atleta de la etnia Uyghur, Denijir Jilamujian, para llevar la antorcha olímpica es un esfuerzo de Pekín para distraer la atención del llamado genocidio en la región de Xinjiang.
Los llamados comentarios de genocidio de Estados Unidos son la gran mentira del siglo y exponen su intento de politizar los Juegos Olímpicos de Invierno y su siniestra intención de utilizar el tema relacionado con Xinjiang para difamar a China.
China asimismo acusó a Estados Unidos de mentir de manera descarada sobre las minorías étnicas, mientras olvida sistemáticamente discriminaciones en su propio suelo.
Estados Unidos llevó a cabo un genocidio contra los nativos americanos en el pasado y ha discriminado sistemáticamente a las minorías raciales a largo plazo. La población de nativos americanos se ha desplomado de 5 millones a finales del siglo XV a unos 250 mil a principios del siglo XX, reduciéndose a una vigésima parte. ¿Qué es el genocidio? Las políticas que Estados Unidos ha impuesto a los nativos americanos son un verdadero genocidio.
Zhao, además de criticar la discriminación racial contra los africanos y asiáticos en Estados Unidos, dijo que elegir a un atleta de la etnia Uyghur muestra que la política de China de promover los deportes de invierno y mejorar la salud de las personas está beneficiando a individuos de todos los grupos étnicos y prueba que no existe discriminación.
Lo que Estados Unidos debería estar haciendo es revisar cuidadosamente sus propios crímenes históricos contra los nativos americanos y tomar medidas concretas para reducir la discriminación racial contra estas personas y otras minorías raciales, como los africanos y asiáticos.
China, en reiteradas ocasiones, ha instado a Estados Unidos a dejar de usar los asuntos vinculados con Xinjiang para difundir mentiras, interferir en los asuntos internos de China o intentar detener el desarrollo del país. Advierte que, de lo contrario, Pekín dará una respuesta más contundente a la luz del desarrollo de la situación. Beatriz Salas con información de Niloufar Shakuri, Hispan TV Noticias.
Migrantes de todos los rincones del mundo duermen bajo su mismo cielo estrellado. Me los encuentro en las calles, en los cines, en los supermercados, y el olor de sus comidas me embriaga de placer. Todos ellos son mis vecinos.
Y yo aquí vivo, bajo sus leyes domésticas, pago impuestos y mis manos producen la riqueza nacional.
Soy parte de esa comunidad que vive, trabaja y sueña con una mañana mejor para nuestras familias.
Casi todos migrantes como yo, casi todos soñadores como yo.
Trabajemos, pues, en la construcción de otra nación que nos haga vivos.
Seamos los arquitectos de nuestro sueño colectivo.
Esta radio no tiene comerciales porque tú nos apoyas. Si ya has hecho una aportación económica, te damos las gracias. Si no, hazlo ahora en kpfk.org o llama al 818-985-5735.
Así llegamos al final de esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Nuestro más profundo agradecimiento a todos los medios y personas que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPod o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
Told me, you know, we'll give you a day, we'll give you a week, however long it takes for you to accept our help to be healed and to become a child of God and denounce being gay.
Honoring the memory of Dr. Anonymous, coming up on the Rainbow Minute.
I got three quarters of the way through several times and was like, well, I have no idea how this would end. so I have to start over. But one thing I know is I can't end a story without hope.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Nicaragua's NGO Purge targets its oldest queer group. Gay Taiwanese movie sings out a universal love song and upending the artistic process with Amanda Kayback. All that and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Joe Bainline.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending August 28, 2021. The government of Nicaragua is aiming to shut down the country's oldest LGBTQ advocacy group. The Interior Ministry has asked the National Assembly to annul the legal nonprofit status of Fundación Xiquequetzal and 14 other non-governmental organizations. President.
And coming up next on Free Radio Santa Cruz on the Net, it's Bathrop Spears Broadsides, the Thursday edition, March 31st, 2022. This is going to be taken up mostly with several lengthy interviews I had with Who'd Not Bombs activist Keith McHenry, who was kind of acting in a slightly different role. He was fulfilling a commitment to Christopher Doyen, also known as Curb Hugger Chris, if you remember him from a decade ago on Free Radio when he was occasionally a co-host with me. And then slightly after that, as Commander X, involved in anonymous justice actions to make those who are harassing homeless people in Santa Cruz and Orlando, in Santa Cruz, this city government, and the police, and in Orlando, well, the same, pretty much. They were harassing Who'd Not Bombs, actually, and there. A price for doing that in terms of overloading their computer system for a brief period of time. I think less brief in Orlando than here. Months ago, when Keith and I went to his hearing, also in San Jose, where I guess he combined the cases from Orlando with the one in Santa Cruz and agreed to have another hearing at which he would make a plea, and then after that another hearing, which is coming up in June, where he would be sentenced anywhere up to 10 years, as I understand it, although I thought it was longer, but not according to Jessica York's recent story in the Santa Cruz Sentinel, which actually appeared, I think it appeared today, the 31st. This interview kind of ranges back in time to the times when Chris Doyen as Commander X was doing his nefarious activities. And Keith McHenry remembers why and how they impacted Food Not Bombs, as well as the SCAMP 2010 movement in Santa Cruz, which was held to protest court abuses against victims of the sleeping ban. In this case, a very particular individual, the two-year-old, I think he was 62, Robert Facer, who had paddled down from Sacramento and maybe all the way from Alaska, if you were to believe his story. He was an Amish minister who slept on the beach in his canoe, kayak, and then later went on the next year to help design and create a large tent for Occupy Santa Cruz, and then died soon after. He was being charged with criminal sleeping in Santa Cruz, as many thousands of others through the years have been charged with, even though Santa Cruz provides no places where they can legally fall asleep. And so they've been a human rights violator, every single one of those police officers who did the arrest, every single one of those city council members who either passed the camping ban ordinance and its various amendments or sat back and let those things happen when they had the power to do otherwise. All of them are violators of basic human rights as specified in Constitution, as specified in various treaties, as specified in various internationally agreed upon documents. Chris Doyen was engaged in making those kinds of violations of human rights, the people who do that pay a cost. And as a consequence, he was eventually, after fleeing and actually living at liberty for 10 years and writing two or maybe three books and doing lots of video journalism and so forth, he was snagged, deported, seized, taken back from Mexico, and that's where we ran into him. I guess it was on Tuesday the 29th, in San Jose Federal Court. Anyway, that's what most of this netcast is about. There's some other stuff, too. I'm throw in some stories that I think attracted my interest, which I hope interest you. Some of them good, some of them not so good. And actually, I'm afraid it's mostly the latter, but there you go. But listen on and listen in.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
Well, I'm here at the being chauffeured over to San Jose by the woman I should be interviewing, but I'm not. Instead, I'm sitting in the back with that old blowhard, Keith McHenry. Hi, Keith.
Hi, yeah, thank you.
And rather than hear historical highlights of your questionable ancestors, what's going on in the reality of today? Why are you here, and where are you going, and what are we doing?
Okay, well, we're going to the Robert Pecknam Federal Building in San Jose to a court hearing, which is, I think, going to be a plea agreement with Christopher Dolan, who's
it's Doyen to you, buddy.
Doyen, and he is also called Commander X, and one of the reasons that I'm supporting him is that he did an amazing action in Orlando, Florida, when we were getting arrested there, where he disrupted, I actually really don't even know what he did, but I was interviewed by the media there, and I didn't get to see the impact or whatever because I was busy being arrested and stuff, but of his I think it was even greater than denial of service. I think they actually put up like images and stuff on the Orlando Chamber of Commerce website and things like that.
Now, you were there to support Orlando's Food Not Bombs against authorities that wanted to severely restrict their activities.
Yeah, so they had created this law, and this is pretty common in liberal democratic cities, where they created an elaborate ordinance designed to make it very difficult, if not impossible, to feed the hungry. So in the case of Orlando, they at one point they urged Food Not Bombs to share food at Lake Eola Park at this picnic area, and they did. They went there. But then that area of town became gentrified in the meantime, and a newly elected city councilor decided that they needed to get rid of Food Not Bombs, so they made one arrest.
Now, was he responding to pressure from neighborhood groups like our own beloved Take Back Santa Cruz in Orlando, or why do you think he took that action?
It was actually a woman. She, and very much like our former mayor, Donna Myers, she had a lot of money, and she was a hobnobber in the lesbian community, I believe, and so she was very woke, and that was so important because that's how she built a lot of support in that neighborhood, which she had investments in, I believe. And
believe, but have no documentation for.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I do know some other city council people in Orlando did own condominiums and investments in that area, and that's also why they supported it.
Was there any indication that the fee, the meals in, what was the name of the park?
That was Lake Eola Park.
Eola Park actually impacted property values? In other words, were real estate people saying, we're being told they won't buy our properties because of all these meals. Is there any evidence of that?
No, I don't think that was that. You know, it's like everywhere. It's just like homeless people in a rich neighborhood, not a great idea. And so the law was sort of fascinating. So in Orlando, there is this huge number of small ponds and lakes, like Lake Eola. And so they made an ordinance that you could only serve in a park twice a year, and you had to get a permit to do it. And it turned out that then if you went to each of the parks, you had to go to all these different random parks. So if you wanted, we were doing two meals a week then. So then you'd have to go to one park and serve there twice, and then you'd have to move to another park and serve there the next week. But then it left out, like, if I recall, something like nearly a month worth of, maybe half a month worth of meals that you just plain couldn't serve. And then, it turned out the other interesting thing was a bunch of these parks were parks where you basically would have to take a bus a long way, and then you have to walk through basically between two people's houses to get to the park, which was obviously, those residents wouldn't be too excited about that necessarily.
Had people, local Food Not Bombs there tried to serve in that park and found through discussions or through their own observation that they were getting less clients?
No, they never did. They ignored it. So once they arrested Eric Menendez,
they refused to serve in the park, and they continued serving where they were.
Yeah, they just ignored the law. And then it ended up in federal court, and eventually they lost the in the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, oddly enough, became our allies later on in the Fort Lauderdale case. But the
what year was this?
That was the year of Occupy.
2011.
Yeah. So, and we had actually proposed, Funabans was going to, you know, this is just a total coincidence, but we had, in preparation for this, at the same time, the Fort Lauderdale police had actually raided the Funabans house, swamp house, in Fort Lauderdale, and broke up the interior of the house, actually kicked in doors, and even though they were renting this place, and they were tormenting Fort Lauderdale. So I had originally went there to Fort Lauderdale to support them, and then we lost the appeal, and then it looked like we were the 30 days after the losing the appeal.
The Orlando appeal.
So then, and there was no court case yet in Fort Lauderdale, and so then we, a bunch of us from Fort Lauderdale went up to Orlando to support what they were doing.
How far away are those two towns from each other?
Oh, I don't know. It's like maybe a four-hour drive or something like that.
Five. Both fairly sizable communities.
Yeah. Fort Lauderdale is a city, basically. It has its own international airport, and it's essentially part of Metro Miami.
Orlando has Disney World?
It has Disney World, and it's a pretty large, it's one of the larger cities in Florida. And and interestingly, the chief of police, who's an African-American woman whose name I can't remember now, she's now a congressperson for that district.
Of Orlando.
And that was the first day we were arrested, was the day she also, was her last day on the force, which is really funny, and not related to us either in any way, just coincidence. I ended up doing 18 days total in jail there.
And you ended up pleading?
And, I pled guilty ultimately to something and paid a few $1,000s to the city.
This is not always typical. On occasion you've done this, but generally you go through the courts in the hopes that a jury will take an effect or the judge will, you know, see sense. Or is that, what's been your, how does that compare with your past experience?
Yeah, usually, except for the three strikes case, which is I pled out on.
1995?
95, yeah. I usually don't. But I was miserable. Like that. So I had a deal where it wasn't going to be a issue, but as I was about to walk into the courtroom where the judge had agreed to release me, and I would be able to go to, you know, have a trial, because I just could not stand it. I had fibromyalgia, and it was very painful. I couldn't call out to anybody, and it was freezing, and that's definitely one of the worst jail experience I've ever had.
What month was this?
And that would have been, I watched the fireworks from Disney World from the, like a tier that you could peek out the window of. So there in the 4th of July.
It was New Year's Eve.
No, it was 4th of July because,
it was cold even then.
Well, in the jails, they keep it at 53 degrees, right? So, and they give you like a little thin cotton thing. My underwear was a size small, so that didn't work. So I just basically, and then a light was on you at all times, 24/7, right above your head in the cell, and you couldn't, the only place you could have a blanket was in your cell. And I shared I shared the cell with two other guys, who were interesting. They were fundamentalist Christians, and it was an interesting conversation. We had a lot of conversations about Denny's, actually. And
Denny's, the restaurant.
Yeah, Denny, yeah, because they both, like, enjoy Denny's, and the one guy had worked in Denny's forever, so we discussed, like, just talked about the different meals you could get in Denny's. It was really weird. And
he spent 18 days there.
Yeah, yeah, it was like a nightmare. I was freezing. And
during that time, it was Chris Doyon, a.k.a. Commander X, I called him Kerbugger Chris, was engaged in, or has been accused of, and is maybe now pleading to, having sort of overwhelmed the Orlando authorities with, what's it called, DDS attacks?
Denial of service attacks. I don't know what he, I got the impression, and that he actually put up images of me and of others being arrested on websites that, with the text that said, "Free Keith McHenry, free food, not bombs." This is what I got from two TV reporters who interviewed me when I was in jail. And they were like, their questioning was two typically blonde Central Florida young women that almost every TV program back then, it seemed like, probably had. I don't know. It just seemed very Central Florida. And they thought I was somehow doing this from inside the jail.
Were you masterminding this?
Yeah. They asked me how I was doing it from inside the jail. So that's what gave me the impression.
Did you tell them how you did it?
I said I had no idea what was even going on until they had were interviewing me. And
so you denied the accusation.
And I asked them if anybody had fallen off a because they said I did millions of dollars worth of damage. And then I feel bad about that, and I go and I tried to buy copies of the video, but the dude never sent them to me from, because that would have been interesting to see the story. But I asked if anybody fell off a ladder or anything as a result and got injured, and I get that they didn't seem to think that happened. And then I also asked them if Disney World and these places that he was supposedly disrupting had telephones so that they could people could call to book their holidays, and they weren't clear about that either, or they didn't comment on that. And so anyway, that was how I knew what was happening. But then later on,
what was your motivation in asking about the phones?
Well, I just thought it was weird that anybody would care. So from that perspective, you know, they supposedly disrupted these tourist sites, and I thought, well, and before the web, people just called up, you know, Disney World and said, "I'd like to book, you know, I'm going to come with 10 kids, and can, you know, how much is that, and we'll come there."
But the business that was supposedly lost was because the new approach to booking reservations at Disney World was online, and if the online service was disrupted, that would mean disaster for the orphans and children who are supported by Disney World.
Yeah, it would be something like that, so that, I think that's what they're implying, yeah. So, but, you know, I had it was early on in cyber-type stuff and like that. Cyber, seems like Chris was sort of a
forerunner?
Yeah, pioneer in cyber civil disobedience. And so that was my experience there. And then also I was interviewed by Liz Tadich. And she was a filmmaker from Australia. So there's three different reporters, Liz being one of them.
Now, was an actual video made of this whole incident that can be accessed online or somehow?
Well, I'm trying to get the video from the two TV companies, but I've never...
That was 11 years ago, and nothing has happened since?
Well, I tried. When Chris and I started doing the live broadcast out of San Lorenzo Park, that's when I did it.
That was last year.
Yeah, that was last year. So, so that once I got out of jail, it was the same time as that woman that supposedly killed her daughter or whatever. That was a famous, went from, you know, there was a, it was what, the second TV court drama after O.J. Simpson. I forget her name, Casey somebody or other or something. And so I was released at the same time she was released, and she'd won her case. And oddly enough, the inmates, everybody, that was because she was a celebrity and it was on TV every day. She, you know, that was the big news all the time, was that. And every once in a while, I would get somebody get arrested and moved to, because you had to, back then I had fibromyalgia and I'd gone cold turkey on morphine and Percocet. And so I was freezing. I was extremely uncomfortable. And then you have to get processed. There's like a processing area that you go in for 7 days. So I did that. And then I was put in this horrible cell area. And, God, I was miserable through that whole thing. So then people that would get out of processing and put it into our unit would say, oh, yeah, you know, 7 days ago, you were still getting arrested serving food downtown. You know, so that's how I would know. But what was happening? And and then back then, yeah, you couldn't call anybody. I couldn't talk to anybody. I had no idea what was happening outside. It was just like stuck in this freezing.
And even though
place.
We began this sort of just to kind of follow the case that we are now going to hear. I don't know whether it's the final chapter, but the latest chapter of any reports on what's happened in Orlando since then regarding Food Not Bombs. Has Food Not Bombs backed off? Are they still doing the same amount of activism they were? Or have authorities backed off? What's going on?
Okay, well, that became interesting. So, Mayor Buddy Dyer was kind of the point person in all this, that, you know, that this he was this one denouncing us and so on. And so Liz Tadich was there to work on this Food Not Bombs documentary, and she does have video of her interview with me in jail. But so she came up with this name, oddly enough, she was calling Bombs or Broccoli, and then she changed it to Food Terrorist. So she had a release form to interview Mayor Dyer, and it called it the Food Terrorist. And so then he then ended up on TV calling us Food Terrorists, getting the idea from this release form that he'd signed with Liz. And that made like a lot of news. And in the end, the thing was just out of control. People kept coming from all over Florida to get arrested. And he then agreed that, he said, look, we'll stop the arrest if they start serving food outside of City Hall, and I'll even add a peppers from my own garden to their soup. So that happened, I think, while I was in jail, maybe right after I got out. And then and so then they just started doing their twice weekly meal there, and that's where they've been doing it ever since.
In front of City Hall.
And it's a much better location, by light years better location, for Food Not Bombs than Lake Eola Park, because it's
the mayor's response to concerns about people coming to Eola Park, or how far away from Eola Park was City Hall?
Oh, it was like four blocks. Yeah, so it was very close. And but the great thing about, so what Lake Eola Park is kind of like where the picnic area is. It's like a little side road, so virtually nobody ever went by there, and no one ever really saw the meal. It would have been completely ignored had it not been for this legal situation. Whereas City Hall is at right where the all the different main intersections of town come together. So people will see this huge line that wraps around City Hall twice a week, one for breakfast and one for lunch. So it's from a political organizing Food Not Bombs point of view, it's many, many times better. So the so we've never been bothered in Orlando ever since. And
Food Not Bombs continued to serve, or
yeah,
not?
Yeah, through the pandemic, they did a lot of like boxed meals that they went around handing out, and but they, I think they're back to City Hall now, and it's not been, and they've gotten to be a much larger organization than they were at the time.
Do they have a literature table?
They did it when I was there, but I don't know if they are.
Do they support political actions in Florida?
Yeah, they do, yeah.
And now a bit of a pause, as I've been doing regularly with these netcasts. A little music from Charlie King.
I could see. Lunchtime one day, she got nostalgic for her youth. Growing up in wartime, under a different roof. She told me, when I was a girl, I loved a soldier in the SS. They only picked the strongest ones, the healthiest, the best. Monsters, they were like your green berets. We never wanted to kill Jews, we just wanted them away. And you know we gave them lots of time until Kristallnacht sealed their fate. We only wanted them to emigrate. Streets. until Kristallnacht seals your fate. We only wanted you to emigrate.
That was Kristallnacht is Coming, sung by Charlie King, or maybe recited by Charlie King, from his album Life and Love, Tears and Laughter, to Keith McHenry. That's McHenry, actually.
Still do.
Yeah, they're still organizing.
What was the last action that you heard they supported?
Are
they mobilizing to support the poor Ukrainians?
I have no idea about that. I know, you know, on occasion, if there's anti-homeless laws, they will resist those.
Talking about the Orlando Food Not Bombs still having a strong basis of political support for peace and justice actions there in Florida. Actually, where we began the interview, this section of it, we'll hear more. Subsequently, there was a lengthy interview after the actual hearing, but first, more music.
Spoon of sand can tip the balance. Drops of water standing, singing still. You weathered the storm. You finished the race. We see by the weary smile upon your face. You've stumbled and risen. You sang up the dawn. You kindled the fire. You carried the torch. Sing it on. Spoon of sand can tip the balance. Drops of water turn a mill. Way out here over the rainbow, someone standing singing still. On the shore, the bottom line bankers, the vultures of war. You turn and you face them, and when push comes to shove, somehow you believe hate has to surrender, surrounded by love. Saw the river run clear. You raised the sail when we thought the journey would end in despair. At the darkest hour, on the edge of the dawn, you caught the first light. You gave us the vision to carry it on. Spoon of sand. Turn a mill.
I ran across an article by Kat Brooks in the San Francisco Chronicle entitled Movement Stalls in Progressive Santa Cruz on Police Reform in the Open Forum column. It's on the 28th that this article got published. Kat Brooks is described as an award-winning actress, playwright, the executive director of the Justice Teams Network, which I haven't heard of before, and the co-founder of the Anti-Police Terror Project, and the co-host of Upfront on KPFA. I don't know about that last. I'm not a big KPFA fan these days, but I liked a lot of the article, and I'm going to read it, or at least some of it for you. After a year that had already seen a spate of officer-involved killings, 2015 ended with San Francisco police officers shooting Mario Woods to death over a kitchen knife. As tragic as that moment was, however, it was also the beginning of an avalanche of movement building. Pressure in the aftermath of the Woods shooting helped turn the San Francisco Police Commission into the strongest civil oversight board in the country, at least in theory. It also led to the hiring of Bill Scott, the San Francisco Police Department chief, under the promise of reform. That same avalanche eventually led to the election of progressive district attorney Chesa Boudin, despite the San Francisco Police Officers Association dumping $400,000 into television ads to defeat him. And this year, for the first time, Boudin put a police officer in San Francisco, Terrence Stengel, on trial for the 2019 beating that left Discari Spears with broken bones and permanent disabilities. Now all that progress is exploding. On the eve of Stengel's trial, Chief Scott, days before he was to face a vote of no confidence from the San Francisco Police Officers Association, very publicly pulled out of a memorandum of understanding with the district attorney's office to allow independent investigations of excessive uses of force. Scott justified his action in part by suggesting that Boudin's office probably withheld evidence from Stengel's defense team, a claim the judge presiding over the trial denied. The dominoes kept tumbling. The police commission, whose job it was to direct Scott, failed to direct the chief to maintain the memorandum of understanding. Then Stengel was found not guilty by a jury that no doubt saw the scandalous headlines. The police commission subsequently lost its most strident critic when John Hamasak announced his resignation, and a recent poll revealed Boudin is likely to fall victim to a recall effort driven by a Republican and police union smear campaign. What the hell is happening in San Francisco? Hamasaki joined the San Francisco Police Commission in 2018 with hopes of riding a national wave of demands for police reform and accountability. And for a minute, he believed a teensy bit of progress was on the horizon. After the memorandum went into effect, there were zero deadly officer-involved shootings in 2019. In 2020 and 2021, there were just one per year. Meanwhile, three officers, in addition to Stengel, were charged for violent behavior, and the city began civilian response programs to combat the community safety crises that can't be solved with badges and guns. Things weren't perfect. A report by the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice showed the department continued to arrest the city's diminishing black population at disparate rates, and recently released data showed black people were 12 times more likely than white people to be subjected to police force. Latinos were 5 times more likely. That's horrific. Some progress is better than none, I guess, better than the backsliding we're looking at now. Hamasaki said Scott's pulling out of the memorandum, that's the memorandum that said there should be independent investigations of excessive uses of force by the police department and not simply an in-house police department-sponsored look at the claims of excessive force. Hamasaki said Scott's pulling out of the memorandum should have been met with headlines that read, San Francisco Police Commission orders Chief Scott to remain in the MOU, Memorandum of Understanding. No such luck. What does our authority matter if we don't use it when our backs are against the wall? He said in an interview. Like so many of us, Hamasaki is tired. Tired and unsure of how to be impactful or effective in a national climate where the elected officials are backing away from demands for police accountability in the face of billionaires funding recall efforts for politicians they could not defeat in democratically run elections. While I believe that we have done some good work, Hamasaki said, we have failed at changing the culture. A culture that balks at accountability. Boudin campaigned on police accountability, and true to his word, he has charged four police officers with abusing their power. And yet these efforts have been a lightning rod. I never suggested that people watch the violent videos that dominate social media, but if you do, you will clearly see Officer Stangel violating any sane interpretation of the San Francisco Police Department's use of force policy in beating Spears. Stangel's trial proceedings reminded us that Spears' girlfriend denied an assault occurred, that Spears was never charged with any crime, and that the Sacramento tourist who called on, who called 911 told the district attorney's office investigators she never actually saw Spears hitting his girlfriend. And it turned out that the ones playing dirty ball in this case were police. The department determined to protect its own, withheld evidence from the prosecution. Stangel walked, nevertheless. And we who live in the supposedly liberal bastion in the Bay Area are left scratching our heads, wondering why, with so much overwhelming evidence, an approved city abuse settlement, and a district attorney willing to hold bad actors to account, was justice not served? Was the jury tainted by media coverage of Scott's move? That's certainly one question. But perhaps the more important ones are this. Where does the department go now? What will happen to Chief Scott's promises of reform and accountability, or to his efforts to change the decades-long violent culture of the department? What message does this send to police about what they can get away with? San Francisco is in danger of regressing to a time when police violence goes unchecked and unfettered. If so, it will undoubtedly make things even more difficult than they already are to push for real change inside the department. If progressive San Francisco can't get it right, the forecast for the nation is grim. That's Cat Brooks, Movement Stalls in Progressive San Francisco, his open forum column in the 28th of March San Francisco Chronicle. And here's another story, also in the Chronicle from the 28th, same paper, same day, by Bob Gelko. Man, no threat to officer before slaying, court rules. A Riverside County Sheriff's Office said Clemente Najera Aguirre was headed towards him with a baseball bat when the officer fired six shots at Najera and killed him. But a coroner's report found that Najera was killed by two shots to his back, and his children can proceed with a suit against the officer, a federal appeals court said Thursday. While Sergeant Dan Plunder still contends Najera posed a threat to him and to bystanders at the time of the shooting in April 2016, the coroner's findings create a factional dispute for a jury to resolve, said the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco. Based on the facts alleged in the lawsuit, Najera, quote, presented no threat at all to the officer or anyone else in that moment, Judge M. Margaret McKeon wrote in the 3-0 ruling. It upheld a federal judge's refusal to dismiss the suit by Najera's three children accusing Plunder of using excessive force. Plunder, a law enforcement officer for 30 years, went to the home in Lake Elsinore after a radio call saying a man was destroying property with a baseball bat and had threatened a woman. The officer got out of his car with his gun drawn and said he saw Najera holding a stick, which he refused to drop. He tried to pepper spray Najera, but the spray mostly blew back in the officer's face and had no apparent effect on Najera, the court said. At that point, witnesses gave different accounts. Some said Najera picked up a baseball bat from a nearby bushes and walked toward Ponder with his one stick raised. Others said he stood still with his stick pointed downward. Ponder fired the fatal shots from 15 feet away, the court said. Citing the coroner's report, McCowan said, that's the judge, the bullet paths suggested that Najera had turned away from the officer and was falling to the ground when the bullet struck. She said there was no evidence that Najera was approaching or threatening bystanders. Ponder's lawyers also argued that even if he had used excessive force, he was legally immune because court cases at the time had not yet established that an officer was barred from shooting a suspect who was carrying a stick or any other weapon, a doctrine known as qualified immunity. But the court said the law was clear-cut. For example, McEwen said a Ninth Circuit ruling in 2013 allowed a suit against a San Diego County officer for fatally shooting a man who was standing 6 to 8 feet away and holding a knife with the blade pointing downward. Another 2013 ruling by the court allowed a suit against three sheriff's deputies in Santa Barbara County for shooting and killing a man who was holding a gun pointed downward while standing on his porch. Those rulings show that officers, quote, must not use deadly force against non-threatening suspects, even if those suspects are armed, McEwen said, or wrote. Gail Galipo, a lawyer for the children, said Najera, 36, had been in a mental health crisis and was acting out, but was not threatening Ponder or anyone else. He said he was pleased the court had set some limitations on qualified immunity, a common ground for dismissing lawsuits against police. And remember, you who are listening to this reading, we're not talking about even firing the police officer or holding him accountable that way. We're just talking about making the city cough up some money so he can continue to do what he always does, if the police chief wants him on. This is just sort of the cost of doing business. Most people are looking for more accountability for excessive use of force, Galipo said. Instead of an officer saying, we're here to help you, they start pointing weapons, shouting commands, and the next thing you know, they're shooting. The Riverside County Sheriff's Office said it respectfully disagrees with the ruling and will examine its options. The county could ask for a full appeals court for a new hearing before a larger panel, appeal to the Supreme Court, or let the case go to trial. And then my comment is, this is by Bob Agelko, this story, man no threat to officer before slaying court rules. But my comment is that there's no district attorney there like Boudin in San Francisco, who's now threatened with recall, who wants to try the officer for murder or manslaughter or in some way hold him responsible for what goes on. We have the same problem here in Santa Cruz. And here's a subject I haven't covered much in recent netcasts, but this article caught my interest. It's in the March 27th Chronicle. Cannabis bill could backfire, critics fear. Loophole in measure may cut patient access, they say. Shelby should say cut patient access even further. It's by Jackie Bryant. Californians voted in favor of Proposition 64 in 2016 and legalized the adult use cannabis industry. They gave municipalities the ability to opt out of cultivation, manufacturing, and retail sales. A new bill appeared to challenge that key provision of local control. It appears to challenge it, but there's an ongoing debate over its intentions and what it would mean in practice. SB 1186 by Senator Scott Wiener would enact the Medicinal Cannabis Patients' Right of Access Act. Good sounding name. It is intended to prevent local governments from enacting bans or unreasonable restrictions around medical cannabis sales. The measure is seeking to ensure that the voter initiative legalizing medical cannabis in California, that's Proposition 215, passed back in 1996, isn't undermined by the more recent Proposition 64, which many of us thought it would be, which legalized recreational adult cannabis use but allowed for local bans on dispensaries. Proposition 64 explicitly did not give cities and counties local control over medical cannabis businesses. The later passage of SB 94 in 2017, the Medicinal Adult Use Cannabis Legislation and Safety Act, was intended to bridge together the medical and adult use propositions and ended up allowing localities to prohibit medical cannabis. If passed, California's local governments would be forced to legalize medical cannabis sales with only a couple of exceptions. Supporters of the bill include Hirsch Jain of the cannabis consultancy Ananda Strategy, are calling it a major milestone in the maturation of the California cannabis industry. Jain, who is also the vice chair of the California Chamber of Commerce and sits on the board of directors for the Los Angeles chapter of NORML, a pro-cannabis advocacy organization, said SB 1186 has the potential to significantly expand retail cannabis access in California by creating markets where they previously didn't exist. He's a market man. Jain said that more than 200 of California's 482 cities ban any form of retail cannabis sales, whether through storefront or delivery, adult use, or medical. This bill would force those 300-plus municipalities to either allow at least one medical cannabis storefront, a delivery service, or both. Opponents of local control provisions say the lack of cannabis access statewide is not only a medical issue for patients, it also provides the illegal market with a way to thrive since customers can't easily access legal cannabis. But there is one line in the bill's current language that has caused pro-cannabis advocates to balk. One section appears to allow local governments to ban delivery while also giving the state the ability to enforce local bans. Lobbyists and lawyers and other advocates said the language is unclear. It gives the local jurisdiction the power to limit medical cannabis sales only to medical delivery or one or more brick-and-mortar storefront, or both, whichever it chooses. The key to the debate, advocates say, is that it provides the option to choose just a storefront and disallow delivery. That could allow a jurisdiction to prohibit new medical cannabis deliveries and to uphold any existing local cannabis sales bans, which state law currently supersedes. Currently, residents in areas with bans can still legally access cannabis through deliveries. As for cannabis access, say the bill could therefore limit, rather than expand, access by creating a loophole. While I fully support the intent of this legislation, the practical application of it is not as simple as most people believe, said Nate Bradley, executive director of the Cannabis Consumer Policy Council. California cities have been fighting long and hard, Bradley said, for the ability to ban deliveries from outside of their jurisdictions. He points to the efforts in 2018 by the then Bureau of Cannabis Control to enact delivery statewide over the objections of the California Police Chiefs Association, League of California Cities, and United Food and Commercial Workers Western States Council, which opposed the rule that eventually became law. He said the language in the bill might allow local governments to enforce complete bans on deliveries. 14% of the sales in California's cannabis market come from deliveries, according to cannabis data company Headset's sample of more than 250 retail connections. Bradley said that though he lives in a cannabis desert city that currently has a ban on sales, he still has access to numerous delivery services. Taking that away and forcing me to make my purchases from a single store that doesn't have to compete and can charge whatever they like does not increase patient access at all, Bradley said. He believes the confusion could be cleared up if the author's office simply amends SB 1186 to clarify that his bill in no way allows cities to ban deliveries from outside their jurisdiction. Weiner's office challenged the notion that the bill does anything to chip away at legal cannabis access. Quote, "The bill does not reduce access in any way," said Katie Stewart, Weiner's communication director. "Cities currently have the ability to ban everything, and almost two-thirds do. This legislation forces city to legalize either delivery or storefront or both. It does not in any way reduce what is currently legal," she said. Stewart said that some jurisdictions with full commercial cannabis bans also ban licensed delivery operators from delivering to addresses within their jurisdiction and enforce these bans with steep fines to licensed delivery operators who violate them. This patchwork of existing prohibitions creates uncertainty for businesses and reduces access for medicinal patients and patients, she said. SB 1186 is intended to provide medicinal access above and beyond what is currently offered. Stewart said, in part, by requiring jurisdictions to provide additional access for medical patients from retailers located in their own neighborhoods. Many of SB 1186's critics agree that the bill appears to create more access, but caution that cannabis legislation has a long history of imprecise language that can create problems down the road requiring legislative cleanup. Bills like this can do a lot of good or immense harm if the language isn't fully clarified, said Hillary Bricken of Los Angeles law firm Harris Bricken. Though the bill does provide a seemingly significant challenge to local control, the kicker is that it's not guaranteed what kind of medical cannabis outfits can be chosen by cities that would be deemed either automatically reasonable or unreasonable under this law, Bricken said. Omar Figueroa, a cannabis lawyer whose firm has offices in Sevastopol and New York, said the bill, if passed, would represent a symbolic rollback of Proposition 64's local control. But he found another potential snag in the language that would have wide-ranging consequences. The bill doesn't prohibit localities from enacting new medical bans in the future. In those local jurisdictions that ban medical cannabis sales entirely, SB 1186 would be an improvement over the status quo. In those local jurisdictions which already allow for medical cannabis sales, SB 1186, if passed, would give local delivery bans the imprimatur of state law, and any new medical delivery bans would erode patient access, Figueroa said. Regarding the delivery quandary, Bricken said the cities wouldn't be able to ban essential parts or services of a medical cannabis business that would allow it to provide access. If a business revolves around delivery and it's medical, the delivery problem couldn't be eliminated, she said. Still, Bricken said, the main question is whether banning delivery would be considered unreasonable if other means of sale are available, like brick and mortar. She thinks the bill doesn't expressly address that aspect. It's a little tricky and confusing, for sure, but it does raise some issues you don't want mainly usually find in mainstream media. So while you ponder that, you can hear a little music.
A whole new meaning to the word antitrust. And you say, you don't know what our demands are. And then you got the boom, and we got the bust. And you say, you don't know what our demands are. You sank our economy without breaking a sweat. Shoot into your gilded safety net, and now you're swimming in credit, and we're drowning in debt. And you say, you don't know what our demands are. Mic check, mic check, mic check, mic check, mic check, mic check. Tear down this wall. This is your last courtesy call. What's gone around is coming round. Tear down, tear down, tear down this wall. You say you're too big to fail, although that's what you do best. And you say you don't know what our demands are. And somehow all of our pensions wind up in your treasure chest. And you say you don't know what our demands are. You emerge from your mansions dressed like third world dictators, screeching, no one can tax us because we're the job creators. So we ask where the jobs are, and you're like, maybe later. And you say you don't know what our demands are. Might check,
might check,
might check,
might check,
might check,
might check.
Tear down this wall. Do you recognize that wrecking ball? That makes a most distinctive sound. Tear down, tear down, tear down this wall. You look down from your skyscrapers and try to sniff the wind, and you say
you don't know what our demands are.
But your windows don't open, and your brokers are chagrined, and you say
you don't know what our demands are.
Your accountants are counting with their fingers in the air as it dawns on your shareholders that you were unaware that there's this whole other meaning of the English word share. And you say you don't know what our demands are. Mike, check.
Mike, check.
Mike, check.
Mike, check.
Mike, check.
Mike, check.
Tear down this wall. From Citibank to City Hall, the implications are profound. Tear down. This is a worldwide wake-up call. We stuck a post-it to your crown. Tear down, 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 tear down this wall.
Was called Our Demands, again from Life and Love, Tears and Laughter, Charlie King. The story that I read to you about the medical marijuana bill that could backfire was from the March 27th Chronicle, and it's by Jackie Bryant, whoever that person may be. Ego freelance journalist, apparently. Hard for even me to follow, I've got to tell you. But I think it's probably worth grabbing an interview with someone local who knows something about this and see what its implications here are for Santa Cruz County. A lot of people favored the Section 64, which legalized some commercial sales of marijuana, not realizing that it would follow essentially a taxation and serious restrictions on medical cannabis, which Proposition 215 had given fairly free rein to. So it was a big boon for large commercial enterprises selling marijuana, but not necessarily for medical users, collectives, or smaller businesses. And, of course, the taxing situation is still pretty seriously horrendous for smaller cannabis dealers, as I understand it, and cannabis suppliers. I'll get in touch, if I ever can, with Pat Malo, who is kind of, I don't know if I'd call him the resident expert, but he seems to know a lot more about it and follow more closely the Board of Supervisors' ins and outs and twists and turns than I do. And before we check out the subsequent conversation with Keith McHenry after the hearing had come and done its thing, here's a couple of speakers at the town clock in the midst of a Food Not Bombs meal giving you some thoughts on a variety of issues.
We're talking with Sean. And Sean, you're saying that, you know, I interrupted your conversation by saying, are you outside? And you said, yeah, but you prefer to be indoors if the truth were known.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, dignity, yeah. You know, I mean, I think it's every, you know, food, clothing, and shelter, it's everyone's right. And, I mean, you know, great nations are judged by the way they treat their people and their animals, for that matter. But, you know, some of them are getting treated more like animals lately.
How do you rate Santa Cruz?
I think actually, well, I have to give it kind of like, maybe like a C minus to almost a D plus on the homeless issue, because I just don't feel like there's any real solutions, though they've made progress on certain things, the homeless shelter here, and certain things they've made some progress on. But as far as people are actually getting housed, I don't see any progress.
Have you used the shelter here much?
Yes. Yeah, and I think, you know, it's gotten a little better with the way that the showers are run there and stuff like that.
Mobile showers still at the 115 Coral?
Yeah, they have the mobile showers, which has been a little bit of an uptick compared to, and of course, shower the people. Thank God for them. But, you know, it's been, the most part, you know, permanent housing is the idea here, and I just think that there's been, they're not really doing what they need to be doing with the funding. You know, this you know, $1 billion from you know, is allocated to fund homelessness, and I don't really see people being housed, and I think that there needs to be coming from people who are on the street, and then there's other things to being housed too, like giving up certain rights and privacies and certain things like that, so that and conditions, you know, it's housed on a condition. And
has anyone promised you in the course of your travels in Santa Cruz and visits to shelters, conversations with service providers, actual housing within a certain period of time? Has that ever been made? Has anybody ever suggested that was a likelihood for you with all the money that's being spent?
Yeah, I mean, there was this operation Lockheed that was supposed to happen for the Monterey County region, but you know, we're talking about Santa Cruz and both Monterey counties, which I think have done a very poor job, very poor, considering the amount of resources they have in the city of Monterey. And well, if you're a woman, you're a lot more likely to get housed. If you're an older adult male, I'd say it's looking pretty slim for any kind of housing in Monterey County. And you know, it's pretty bad here in Santa Cruz. This is, that tent city over there in the back, I mean, that just can't be a permanent thing. I mean, they really need to find housing and get people out of the San Lorenzo Park there on the Sanzo River.
Spend much time in the Brenchland.
Excuse me?
Have you spent much time in the San Lorenzo Park benchlands?
No, I've been through there, and I don't feel safe there. And that's another thing. It's just not a safe, conductive, healthy environment. You know, I know they sort of regulate themselves in there, but it's just, as far as like moving to more of a constructive, eco-village, sustainable lifestyle, which really, under this Green New Deal, under the United Nations, Agenda 21, they're pushing us into this new Green Deal. They need to be offering more green solutions. And so, land, federal land grant, federal land opening up for homeless, even state land that could be opened up for homeless would be a big step in the right direction of creating an eco-sustainable kind of where people can feel more like they're being a part of something, and getting back into society means feeling like you're a whole person on the inside, spiritually connected with the planet. I don't think if people are given the dignity, it's more than just a free meal. This is about getting people to be able to feel like they have a purpose in life. And that's, it's hard when you're on the streets to feel like you have a purpose for anything when you look down upon all the time. I see a lot of that.
More in Santa Cruz or more in Monterey?
I see it in both places, actually. Yeah. Santa Cruz, really rough here. I believe it's got the highest rate of actually homeless children in the state of California, which is also a shocker.
Has it changed much in your tenancy here? How long have you been here?
I've been here since 1980.
So you've got quite a swath of time to look over.
Oh, yeah. I've seen big changes, like housing go through the roof, housing being bought up by Silicon Valley here in Santa Cruz, specifically after 89, after the earthquake. And, prices skyrocketed. A lot of local people couldn't afford to live here anymore. A lot of people had to leave Santa Cruz that were born and raised around here. Monterey is just as bad. You can't find anything anymore. I mean, there used to be granny units. There used to be small little places you could rent that were sustainable, that were low enough that you could, afford it. But now it's almost impossible. And now with inflation under this great reset, it's just going to keep rising. Things are just going to get tougher unless we can really find some real true leadership, which I think most of the leadership when it comes to the homeless issue has failed us. And most of the leaders around the homeless issue within Santa Cruz, here, the Bay Area, and you could probably many other places in California have failed us. With a lot of it with like in Los Angeles with the Supreme Court decision to allow people to sleep in their vehicle, but city ordinances, like the city of Monterey, still going after people, law-abiding people that work, live in their cars, some are homeless, some work. Housing is a right, and you can't go after people in vehicles if the Supreme Court stated in the state of California you have the right to be in your vehicle, but city ordinances say no. So this is a big contradiction to the way people are treated homeless. I often feel like the homeless are targeted. They're targeted in many, many different ways. Targeted by, it could be anything from parking meters to don't like the way you look to you can't be here anymore. A lot of violations of people's, civil liberties.
Any encounters with police
and
less?
Civil liberties and American sovereignty, yeah.
Any encounters with local police that you want to comment on?
Not too much. Because I think many people who are actually homeless are actually law-abiding citizens and are actually not out doing crimes. Addicts either. So there's a lot of people who just happen to be in a very, very tough situation, who are just not able to find housing or to afford housing under the current market in California.
And it's, you're one of them, I would take it.
Oh, I've been one of them a long time, and if I could find affordable rent, I would have tried to find it a long time ago. I haven't been able to find any affordable rent. And for someone that wants to, doesn't want to be with roommates and all this kind of thing, with roommates and that sort of thing, there's many people that like their own privacy, and put it that way. So it's difficult for everybody to be living with roommates.
And we've been talking with them.
Yes.
I'm examining some interesting jewelry. Town clock. I'm learning some of the tricks of the trade. You're not going to divulge how much you can find actually finding this material.
That's true. Yeah. That's the labor of love.
And these are wraps that are. What do you call these earrings, pendants?
It's a talisman.
They look pretty reasonably priced to me. This is not any kind of fancy $1,000 for some of your work.
work here.
Well, it costs more if you drive a Tesla.
I see. So abandon your Tesla before coming here.
Oh, no, no, be honest. Honesty is a good policy.
So there's a vending law that passed on the first reading. I don't know if you heard about that. It's throwing vendors into limited spaces. I don't know. I don't think they can limit what you're selling this time because of the state law, but I think they're limiting the hours you can do it, places you can do it. They may have the move-along law back. I'm not sure about that. What's your thought about that, if you want to say?
Well, you know, I do a performance whenever I'm, quote unquote, vending. So they're going to have a hard time knowing if I'm accepting a donation for my performance. You know, I can play on the drum for a half hour. I can sell some jewelry for a couple minutes. I can sing a song, a cappella.
Any song you'd like to sing at the moment?
I like the Exposed Hypocrite.
Is that the name of your first song, perhaps?
No, I'm just saying that, I mean, line at the welfare office. So, you know, the people that are creating microeconomies and creating their own wealth, that should be promoted. I mean, a lot of people come downtown for the street vendors.
I, of course, agree with you. The question is, what kind of response can be made by the community to deal with a city council that seems to be, I don't know if they're concerned with making money or driving poor street vendors away. What's your thought about that?
I take it case by case. I mean, I don't see it as a city council. I see it as individuals. And we've all got a lot to learn, and nobody's perfect. But at the same time, I feel like, if you're not actually holding the council in person, if you're doing it via Zoom, that doesn't feel like a council to me. You're too disconnected from the other council members.
And from the community.
Yeah, I mean, the community is part of the process, even if they're not part of the same council.
I agree. If you want.
Yeah, I mean, it's just going to be a hard time for the vendors to have, like, six tables, seven tables. They're going to probably have to downsize a little bit.
Are the vendors actually have so many tables? Or no, you used to have two tables.
I mean, you know, they're selling bigger stuff, so they need more space. And maybe they only come out on the weekend or whatever, but it's just a give or take. I mean, you know, we all got to share the space. Some people do get a little territorial. I can see it from both sides, you know. And I'm sure the city council people, they're going to come around. I'm sure they have good intentions.
Forgiving heart, I can see that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they're people. You know, they're probably stressed out. And
politics, you become a part of a machine rather than you kind of abandon your human identity for your role as whatever it is, where it's police or on the council, and then you become really something different than you were. That's what I've found. You may have found differently.
I think a lot of them really open-minded, compassionate politicians have become disillusioned. I think they have dropped out. financially motivated types have risen to the places of power. So what we need is the oversight, censure of people to come and say, hey, like, stay on track, you know? I agree. And we've been talking with, if you wish to say. My name's Jaya.
Thank you, Jaya.
You're welcome. We're talking with
Sean.
And Sean, you're...
So now we come to part two of the interview with Keith McHenry on the return trip back from San Jose to Santa Cruz, where, we get into a variety of topics, some of it springing from the court case, some of it springing from goodness knows where.
So today is March 29th. We're returning from the hearing, which I'm not quite sure what they did other than a lengthy plea by Chris Doyen. All he said was, yes, ma'am, yes, ma'am, yes, ma'am, to the judge. At least he didn't say, Your Honor. I mean, that was a good thing. I thought that was, I'll give him credit for that one. Any reaction to the hearing? What is me? I mean, I don't know. There was nothing really surprising. He pled guilty to all, what was it, three or four charges, and it was postponed for sentencing until June 28th, right?
Yeah, I believe, I think it's 28th. So the, it was interesting listening to the federal prosecutor read out the, particularly the Orlando case, and to read the, and to actually state, well, both of the things that I think was most interesting was is reading the camping ban law into the record, and reading the large group feeding ordinance in Orlando into the record.
Or at least the reference to it. I don't think there was much of the substance of it mentioned.
The camping ban one, there was not much substance. There was more substance to the Orlando large group feeding, where it kind of was damning. To me, it seemed like it would be obviously damning and embarrassing to be standing up there saying that somebody that did a nonviolent protest against that was should go to federal prison for that. I thought it was not the federal prosecutor and I actually did a nice concise job with the large group of describing the large group feeding, which was that you had to get permit for each park. You could only do two times in a year in a park, and the idea that adult humans that are being paid in Buddy Dyer's case, like probably a couple hundred thousand dollars a year to be a mayor, would actually think that even made any sense. It's sort of like all these. Either they're just so viciously cruel, or they're just have this amazing class blindness that they can't imagine the logistics. Well, a lot of it is that they don't do anything physical in the world anyway, so they have no idea what actually doing things in the
world.
They
being
like federal prosecutors or judges or city officials. They have no idea what feeding people is about. If you come up with an imaginary idea that people are going to move around from each park to each park each week to find food, and you have no resources and you have to do it by walking and you have to defend all your property and you haven't, it's bad enough that you're going to only eat twice a week anyway. It's insanity, it's just like here in Santa Cruz where, that's why I wrote that essay that then became John Malcolm's article in the Sentinel, belatedly. Because the reality is there's all these logistics to just making sure people get food, and then there's the logistics of being a homeless person, right? It's like this immense trip, but they create these weird laws, like the large group feeding law in And large group being 25, I mean, we were having so many more people come to eat and in Orlando. And now it's like, you know, in the photos I've most recently seen, it's like wrapped around City Hall. So, yeah, it's just incredible that you could be, and I assume a federal prosecutor in San Jose gets, you know, probably $200,000 a year to do that. And they're just living in the, it's like a, such a, it's embarrassing that we, you know, those people should be embarrassed that they would even stand up there in a court before a judge and read that law, and then in conjunction with sending somebody to prison for protesting that law. I mean, that's incredible.
What I noticed was at the courtroom itself, the most natural human response, which is to laugh or become outraged, is completely suppressed by the whole structure of the court. And so it doesn't even begin to, there's no access to real human feeling, and so how can you, I mean, even, you know, the idea that somebody should be forced to flee and live in secret for, 11 years abroad for this kind of behavior is, you know, absurd, outrageous, say whatever you want, but it's something that if you're considering the actual human costs over the day-to-day and the kind of pain that it has produced, it's something that would provoke a real cry of rage, and it would be necessary to say, to express that in order to get a real response, if the court were doing a real response to this situation. But of course they're not. It's a sort of a zombified, automated, one size fits all, in a way, self-perpetuating kind of a juggernaut.
Yeah, well, I think that's the, you know, we're going towards this and dystopian corporate future where everything is sterilized, you know, like the, you know, just the building of the buildings in these cities where it's completely sterilized, everything's inhuman, and things like eating and pooping and things that people have been done since the beginning of people are just completely, you know, outlawed or stifled. But you can, you know, but any kind of technological oppression is hailed and supported, you know. And yeah, I think the court is a reflection of the soulness of the entire economic and political system, you know, that...
Kathleen, did you have any reaction that you wanted to say to the hearing?
No, thank you. It's just... I'll get too distracted from driving. But,
I gotcha. Yeah, I don't want you to go off the road, particularly since I'm in the back seat, you know.
Okay. Yeah, because, I mean, it's a... When you, yeah, it's a, that's why I call the city council in Santa Cruz celluloid avatars, because they're essentially not real. I mean, and they don't make decisions that are about reality except for to harm people. You know, it's a, or you look at the, you know, it's just, the whole thing is completely outrageous, and you do get a sense that. You know, there's going to be two tiers of society. There's going to be those of us that stand outside all this stuff and just continue to survive on the streets and are free, are actually relatively free. At least our minds are free. And then there's going to be everybody else that falls for the propaganda of the corporate media and the education system and the court system and all that. You know, it's just. No, you're doing fine.
Oh.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah.
You're
cool.
Close to the turnoff.
I thought I missed it.
Yeah. No, it's a double turnoff. So. Anyway, it is really frightening and brutal.
Let me get back to this issue that I was. You talked to me about this off mic earlier when we were kind of getting ready to go into court. There's been a lot of. Well, there's been a lot less protest, at least locally in Santa Cruz, in the last year or two, partially, you know, COVID fear related, partially gentrification related. But one of the other considerations that you brought up is that the nature of protest has changed because the possible violent responses by authorities are so much more likely, perhaps. I'm not quite sure how you put it.
Okay, so in the original book, Food Not Bombs, How to Feed the Hungry and Build Community, my co-author was very, he really, and I agree with the spirit of this, of non-cooperation. So he would go limp and I'm not going to be cooperating with being taken to jail. And so anytime he was doing a civil disobedience of some sort, which was only a couple of times around food, it was mostly anti-war, anti-nuclear.
You're talking about C.T. Butler, right?
Yeah, this would be C.T. Lawrence Butler. So we had a section in there on going limp and non-cooperation. And
you ever done that?
No, I've never done that. I only did civil disobedience in a traditional sense. One time at the Pentagon in like 1979, but I escaped from custody, which was a fortunate thing. Two theatrical civil disobedience, where you get arrested intentionally type of thing in Tucson during the beginning of the Iraq War and Afghanistan War. Otherwise, even though I've been arrested over 120 times or maybe 150 times, something like that, they're always usually just for living, you know, like serving food. I don't do that thing.
Engaged in legitimate activity, which they regard as illegitimate, and go in and try to stop you.
Correct, yeah. I figure I get arrested enough for that I didn't need to do the others. In fact, at the beginning of the Iraq War, or whatever war it was, I get... The one with after 9/11, I was...
Okay, that was 2003.
Yeah, I did United Neighbors weapons inspection of Raytheon missile systems to see if they had weapons of mass destruction there, and I was arrested doing that, walking onto Raytheon property. That would be somewhat like a civil disobedience of a traditional sort. And the other one was we did a die-in in front of a congressperson's office around that same time, but I also got arrested for just marching down the street one time on a Sunday with no traffic, and pretty brutally arrested, and then several people were injured in that march.
You had a difference of opinion with C.T. Butler. Some of it had to do with commercialization, but some of it also had to do with a difference of opinion on the proper way to advise people to resist unjust authority and protest.
No, that's not actually accurate. I mean, one, the first is accurate, the second is not. So when I went through the original book, which was written in 1992,
it was called
Food Not Bombs, How to Feed the Hungry and Build Community, did not object to the sections in there on going limp and doing, non-cooperation. I mean, philosophically, I was completely in support of that. And in those days, when you did that, you might get banged up, but you weren't going to be hospitalized. By the time I rewrote the book as Hungry for Peace, which was I don't remember where I rewrote that, but which is weird, but
more or less.
Yeah, in the it must have been in, I don't know when that book came out, in the 2000s sometimes, and so I was living in Taos, New Mexico, because I hired an editor that wasn't so good with grammar, actually, so I was in Taos, I was a Taos editor, so that had to be after 2003, and I think it must have been in something like...
Of course, course of a decade, your sense of what the most appropriate approach was has changed?
Yeah, well, the point of that book was I didn't want young, the point to me is I didn't want to be as an older seasoned activist suggesting to younger people who would be reading my book that there was some kind of, it was safe to do what I wrote in the first book. And the reason that I say that is originally I thought I was just going to copy the first book, and that was funny because I actually, the only reason I had a copy of the first book is a person who was arrested for possession of marijuana in Colorado, of all things, had to do community service, and I've lost the computer program that the original book was written on. That company no longer existed, and that program no longer existed, and I could no longer access the files. So he retyped the entire book, and then I went to think I was just going to update it, and then as I read that part, I said, no, I can't let people think that that's a safe thing to do. So that's where I got the impression why I changed that. It wasn't a personal dispute between me and CT. Now, the dispute, reason I wrote that book, and the two reasons why I completely rewrote the book, one so much, or maybe more, but one of them is that we had no real computer files of that book. We were just reprinting it as from film, and I was adding like, four pages at the beginning, four pages at the end. And my publisher, Chaz Buffet at CJR Press, suggested that that was getting old because we kept selling out and we kept having new editions. So I decided to rewrite it. But the other thing is that I had been in a dispute with C.T. Lawrence Butler over the issue of, he was approached me to try to become my manager and use his and my fame, so to speak, to make money off of the fact that we both were co-founders of Food Not Bombs, and I felt that was in no way in the spirit of Food Not Bombs, and particularly found that it would be crushing to the thousands of young people that were doing Food Not Bombs if something like that were to occur. That must have been in like about 2010 or something like that, that conflict happened. And he was pressuring me to basically parlay our fame into that. And I didn't want to do it.
You've written up. I don't want to get too much into you, Keith, although that almost always happens. And when we spoke, I guess it was yesterday or the day before. Day before, I think. Maybe it was yesterday. I was looking for updates, and you frequently have a lot of, you're doing a lot of stuff to keep the Food Not Bombs meal going and maintaining connection with Food Not Bombs organizations elsewhere, and also keeping an eye on what's going on with anti-homeless laws in Santa Cruz, as well as getting reports from homeless people about, and renters who are displaced, about what's going on there. So I have to ask you, even though I asked you recently, anything new?
Well, I mean, I think the last time I spoke to you was I'd just gone through San Lorenzo Park again, and no one there had heard any updates on being evicted from the park. And that still seemed to be the case the day after that I went down there to see if any news. People are complaining that many more people, so when I was hanging out there the other day, people were mentioning that a lot more people seemed to be showing up. I was overwhelmed with tent requests, which I'm sure will happen again today. So I ran out of my first load of tents almost immediately when I arrived at the meal, so I had to go back and get another load of tents. And what I do is I buy every tent under like $40 at Big Five, negotiate with them, I think I bought 24 tents last time. I still might have 8 left out of that. So that's like a, that's insane.
How often do you give a tent to someone who asks, and how often do you decline to do it for different reasons?
I will hassle the, there's one or two people that are repeat requesters, and I deny them every second or third time because I know they're just basically, I don't totally begrudge them selling the tents to buy whatever it is they need, but I don't want them to
make a business
out of it. Make it a huge business out of it, you know.
And we'll hear more about the woes and wherefores of being one of the few suppliers of homeless survival gear in Santa Cruz, free survival gear, after this music.
Grandpa Babe died while he was shaving. Took him 3 days before they found him out. In the cabin where he lived up on Mill Creek, where the flies swarmed around his mouth. The day he died was 20 years since the fire that took Mildred, Vicey, little Jane. Branches brush the grave of Grandpa.
Antoinette was called Middle Creek. In case I didn't mention it, I thought I did, but in case I didn't, the previous number by Charlie King was Our Demands. Back to Keith McHenry.
But, you know, I've been around. I know, you know, if somebody's asking for... Now, the other thing that I'm getting a fair bit more stories of about these tents is that people will report that they left to go do something, came back, and somebody had moved into their tent. And I know a couple of the people that do that, I know, and I can completely imagine... So one of the people that I know has occupied at least two different people's tents over the that I've observed when they were, you know, he was climbing into people's tents and living in them at Lot 27. And he's completely filthy and intense. He's a really nice person, but you know, he's incredibly messy. He often has food all over him, and he lays on the ground basically all the time and stuff like that. So I can totally imagine if you came back to your tent and found him in your tent, you would abandon that tent to him. So that's not unusual. But there's other cases where whole, you know, like a couple will move into somebody's tent when, and they just won't leave, and you gotta get into a huge altercation. So I hear that story once in a while as well. So
a lot of people, even a week ago, Monday, when I was trekking down the Hell's Trail and talking to a few people, they were being bulldozed out in another, you know, one of the series of sequential bulldozings that have happened in the last 6 months, whether at Highway 1 and Highway 9 or earlier in the Pogonip or after that along the initial Hell's Trail bulldozing, then the Camp Paradise bulldozing, then the Hell's Trail bulldozing, then the levee removal of tents. It seems that a lot of people are losing their property, or maybe they're taking it with them, and they're being told that, of course, this is the interesting story that probably doesn't sit too well with conservative folks in Santa Cruz, that the new sanctioned campground is the Benchlands. And therefore, because there's a sanctioned campground, the Community Services and Standards Act, which I probably am reversing the order, I think the Community Standards and Services Act, it's a new camping ban, can go into effect because there is a supposedly space for 150 people and storage as well, because they can always store their stuff in their tents, see, in the San Lorenzo Park benchlands. But I guess I'm wondering, is there a lot of people are, maybe, it looks like, are losing their tents. Are they coming to you for them? And certainly it's going to be more than 24, right?
Yeah, well, there is. So, like, a person wanted to know if my tent was better than a homeless person's healthcare project tent. So we all buy our tent. They buy their. In the past, they've been buying their tents at Big Five, and I buy them at Big Five, and I try to get there. I always go on a Sunday morning and then negotiate and see. They have these yellow tags, which are for sale tags, and then they are kind enough to go through the yellow tags to see which tents have gone down in price that week, and then I buy all the tents if they're, like I say, under $40, So I know this. The county does that. I did buy one time a bunch of them on, online, but they were even worse than the cheap tents at Big Five. So I stopped that.
So HBHB is actually giving out tents too, and so is the county.
Well, I think when the county gives out tents, it's HBHB. And there was this clandestine county tent distribution that Matthew was doing, but he's retired again. He used to be one of the main people at Homeless Persons Healthcare Project. But I did talk, so in this weird, you know, here we are, the amazingly wealthy area of the world, and Crystal, who's in the, you know, in the union, she is partially taking care of a senior and getting to bathe at their house and stuff like that. She's one of two in-house support people, but for this person, and but she's hoping to get a, and this is sad that you get to reduced to this, but she's hoping to get into 1220 River Street to the Boneyard campground, but she hasn't yet. I mean, that's sad, man, that that's happening. And then, you know, so I haven't been over there to see what's going on there and you know, all that. But then, you know, that's the, you know, people are like scrambling for these like really inhumane locations. And because they're better than the other inhumane locations. And then the, and it is tragic that the Benchlands is being considered by allowing people to live there through our lawsuit, which they would never have been there if it wasn't for the union and Food Not Bombs and people suing federal court.
And the community coming out to stop the evictions at the upper Benchland.
Yeah, that was a really
duck pond.
Yeah, that was a really important action. That gave us time to file the lawsuit, and it gave us time to have the case not be moot before it got heard, before Van Kluen. So that was super important. And the
there was always a lot of concern that and the injunction was vacated and removed at the end of June of last year, that when that was going to happen or soon thereafter or certainly before the winter and the floods, they would be moving people out of the Benchlands, and the union began to meet, the Santa Cruz Homeless Union began to meet weekly to talk about strategies and try to involve itself with other organizations, Democratic Socialists, Love Boat, so forth. A huff, even, to devise a strategy that would discourage the, ironically, the depopulation of the Benchlands, which actually apparently worked in a way. But on the other hand, there is still a depopulation supposedly slated for this summer. That's according to Matt Huffaker, the city manager, and his go-to guy, Larry Imwalda, or that's his name. What kind of strategies, and I know the union hasn't been meeting recently for all kinds of reasons, but as sort of an onlooker who's had some experience with this stuff, although admittedly not a Benchlands resident, you would have, what kind of considerations would you be thinking about to deal with this upcoming crisis?
Well, I mean, it is very difficult. We still have all the Santa Cruz neighbors documents that we were going to use. I still have a pile of those and stuff. I don't know. We might want to reactivate whatever that was. I know one thing did come out of that, which was...
Explain more clearly what you mean.
So we were trying to go around the neighborhood and where people were staying, or in other neighborhoods where a potential camp could be put, and build solidarity amongst the unhoused, the housed people, to not, you know, organize to get rid of people. And a little bit of that did happen on the west side. That seemed, but I don't know what kind of impact that had. It does seem like the sympathy, because of the extreme poverty and people being on the edge, I get a sense. So our problem is that there's a silent majority that's completely disorganized, whereas the people that are vocally against homeless people are connected, are organized, and know each other. But really a vast majority of the people in the town seem to show some sympathy, and that's reflected in their coming by and bringing things to Food Not Bombs, and it's reflected in their coming to the Benchlands with supplies, and a lot of it is like, you know, churches and stuff that are, small congregations that are just do it out of the goodness of their heart, things like that. So I think there is a lot of sympathy now for people living outside. And I think partially that is because the people living outside aren't so visible in a way, because they all are on the Benchlands mostly. You know, they're always frequently kicked out of doorways. Although the doorways are, I just saw the doorways having a bunch of people again in downtown the last couple of days. And and there's actually new people that I haven't seen before that may have been unhoused in other communities and showed up. It's hard to really say. They could have been just housed recently and recently unhoused, although often I can tell that because they, you know, look stunned and have still have good clothes on. I don't know. We have to come up with some kind of thing. I don't know what to... And then reading that ordinance, it just seems completely...
The CSSO ordinance?
Yeah, that seems completely...
That's the new camping ban. You can find it, by the way, anybody listening who wants to go research it, just go to the city's website or look up Santa Cruz Municipal Code.